Well, here's a traveller's tale for you to end our program. It's to Tobin Hartnell. He's an Australian archaeologist who specialises in Mesopotamia, one of the oldest civilizations in the world that's now present-day Iraq. But in 2014, the Daesh group, or Islamic State, began to spread through northern Iraq and thousands were fleeing or fighting. But Tobin Hartnell, his Iranian wife and young daughter, were headed into the eye of the storm to start a new life. They were headed for the city of Sulaymaniyah in Iraqi Kurdistan, the heartland of the region fiercely defended by the Kurds, where Tobin's taken up a post to head up the newest archaeology program in the region at the American University of Iraq. Tobin Hartnell joined me earlier this week.
Thank you.
That journey, before we get into what you're really doing, what was it like for you and your family? Were you apprehensive?
The journey was actually one of the most difficult I've taken, and I've travelled a lot over the last 40 years. I guess what was the most apprehensive was just the uncertainty of what we would find. And when we got into Sulaymaniyah, we were pleasantly surprised that actually Sulaymaniyah is very safe. The Kurds have a very tight security on the KRG region, and you can feel completely at home in Sulaymaniyah.
You can lead a normal life there, can you? I mean, have you got sort of electricity and water, clean water, and schools operate and all that sort of thing?
Well, as you might anticipate, we would lose power every day a couple of times. Water is mostly available. Electricity and internet are mostly available. So it's just a matter of good scheduling, really. The problem for Kurdistan is once you leave the cities. So when you're in Erbil and Sulaymaniyah, life is good. There's a lot of security on the streets. But when you leave the cities, you see the situation with lots of refugees and lots of economic problems that are being caused by this war.
And your wife, Yalda, and your daughter, how old is your daughter now?
My daughter, Andia, is 5, and she's in the French school. There's great schools here. There's a French school, a British school, and there's a couple of good local Kurdish, Turkish schools. So there's a lot of opportunities for her, surprisingly, and we were impressed by that.
And is your, I think your wife is an historian, is that, she's Iranian, isn't she?
My wife is a Persian, yes. She grew up in Tehran during the Iran-Iraq war, and she moved to Australia when she was about 25. And since then, we've travelled the world together. So she's an art historian, and she works on ancient Iran mostly, so prehistoric Iran especially, things that are like 5 to 10,000 years old.
You're really quite a couple, aren't you? And there is much left to discover, I gather, in Iraqi Kurdistan. In the article that I read about you, which really piqued my interest, it was described really as a sort of tabula rasa in terms of terra incognita of history, as I think one of the other archaeologists described it. Why is this so?
Well, in the 50s and 60s, people did work here because this is the oldest part of Iraq. In the Ice Age, people were living in the caves, they were hunting here. So there was an interest in Kurdistan, but that disappeared once the Iraqi state turned more Arab. And then there was a lot of discrimination against this region. So the only major project that really happened was the Erbil Citadel. And a lot of Kurds think that that was a badly mismanaged project. Now, since the KRG has formed, archaeology is coming into the region, but it's been focused again on that prehistory and on Christian issues mostly. And I think what we're missing is that this is one of the great ancient, part of the great ancient kingdoms of the ancient world, which we call Media. And that's basically an unknown kingdom. And that's what I'm here for.
Just because that acronym keeps coming up, the KRG is the Kurdish Regional Government, is that right?
The KRG, the Kurdish Regional Government.
Right, yes. Okay. So can you get out into the field, Tobin? Is it safe? Like you just said, it wasn't particularly safe out, or different outside the cities. Are you comfortable trying to do orthodox archaeological work?
I would say archaeology everywhere needs to change. And I don't think orthodox archaeology will survive the budget cuts and the crises that tend to be happening all over the world. We don't have a lot of money for the humanities. So archaeology is moving high tech, and there will be a place for archaeology everywhere as long as it's very cognizant of what it can achieve and for how much. So, you know, we're a small university. We don't have a huge budget, so we're moving high tech. That involves doing unmanned aerial surveys. That involves doing geophysics, this type of work. And only once we've done that sort of prep work, that will tell you already what's under the ground or give you some clues. Then we can do targeted excavations because that's the most expensive part.
So you're effectively using drones, are you, to do this mapping and see ancient river systems and lakes and pre-modern habitation sites and so on. And then when you're satisfied, almost like a military operation, you then go out into the field.
Well, what we really want to do is test sort of the cutting edge of what this drone technology can do, which we know that agriculture responds to subsoil conditions, and we know that archaeology affects how the soil works. So the drone should be able to pick up on ancient streets, ancient canals, ancient walls, especially if they're big enough, so they're monumental structures. We have to take images every month to sort of document the land, and we have to take, we call it resistivity. We can use electricity to see what's in the way, if there's a wall in the way. So we use the drone and the electrical resistivity and match them together and see if this can actually map for us what the ancient city was like.
Oh, absolutely fascinating, because I assume there'd be layers and layers of earth and sand and other habitation, and you've got to penetrate all this, am I right, to get to the original?
Well, what we see on the surface is what's melted from generation after generation of these cities being abandoned. So, but what you'll find is that something like this geophysics, the resistivity survey, can actually look sort of layer by layer under the ground. So it can look down up to 20, 30 meters and see if there's a major building there. We're only using it for the first 5 meters because the closer you look to the surface, the more detail you get. So we want to sort of get street plans and house plans. We don't want to get what's 30 metres under the ground. The archaeology should be finished by then.
What an extraordinary venture. Tobin Hartnell's my guest, an Australian archaeologist who's working in Kurdistan in northern Iraq at the American University, which is a relatively safe area of Iraqi Kurdistan. What about the students? Because I understand you're really heading up a new program to train the next generation, or a first generation of Kurdish archaeologists, in effect, since the 50s. How's that going?
Well, we've actually had a lot of success so far. Actually, the students have been the most rewarding part of the job. So when we first started archaeology class last year, both classes were overfilled. We opened two sections and we had 60 students, and we thought, let's just keep that for now and we can open up again next year. But this, we're already at next year. We have another 60 students entering who want to study and take a minor in history with archaeology as their focus. So not all of them will take archaeology on, but there's a lot of interest in what we do and how we do it. So using technology gives them the skills that they can to do historical research, and then it gives them a job skill afterwards if that isn't their career choice. But what our goal is to get students enough education that they can get into the graduate programs in Europe and America and become the next generation.
And this is despite, maybe it's because of, I wonder what you think, the truly dreadful material that has emerged from IS's interaction with archaeology. You know, places with scholars like Khaled al-Assad, really the martyr, the Palmyra scholar, who reportedly refused to cooperate with IS and was beheaded by them last year. So is that discussed among your students?
I think the general response for most people is disgust. I mean, students here don't actually know that much about Hatra and Nimrud. So when they've seen it, when they've seen how special these places were, and then they see what was destroyed, then they start to understand what the scale of this ISIS destruction is. I mean, it's really destroying civilization after civilization, Christian, Assyrian, Median, anything that is not conforming to their worldview is apt to be destroyed. And just as a sign, we organized a cultural heritage conference last year, and we had the head of UNESCO from Iraq come up to give a speech. We had a lot of interesting speakers, but what I was most impressed about is the room was packed. We had 300 people there, And that's because there's a sort of groundswell of interest in, like, well, what can we do about this? Mm. We've talked about how bad it is, but what can we do? So this year we're doing the same conference with Oxford to train people in cultural heritage to sort of say, well, this is what you can do.
And the claims that ISIS regularly makes, you know, that it wants to form a caliphate, a state governed in accordance with Islamic law or Sharia, you know, part of that whole history, the glorious part of the history of Islam, which seems to exercise some amazing hold over some Muslims anyway. Well, how do you contextualise that for these students of yours?
Well, the thing about the caliphate is when you look at the archaeology, and my study tends to be in the first millennium BC, first millennium AD, so it covers the early part of the caliphate. And when you look at the archaeology is very strong. There's a lot of evidence for urbanism and economic development right up until about the end of the 10th century, which means that the world is getting bigger and bigger and developing more and more aggressively in the Middle East. The Middle East is a world-leading civilization, and it's centered in Baghdad. And so the caliphate was one of the great civilizations in the history of the world. But what the ISIS gets wrong is the caliphate was so great because it was open to the world, because it was cosmopolitan, because there were Christians, Jews, Yazidis, because there was all these different people contributing to its success. And they mistake the success for a very narrow worldview, when in fact the caliphate, they were very open to Greek philosophy and Indian mathematics, and this was a very cosmopolitan place. Mm. So that's where I try and contextualize it. I think the best way to contextualize it is by looking at the contributions that the caliphate made to world science and world civilization.
So do you plan to stay there? I mean, are you seeing your future, yours and Yalda's future, in this part of the world?
Well, we plan to stay in the Middle East. So what the initial plan was 4 years here. And 4 years gives us enough time to sort of build something that can go on. So that was the initial plan. We've had a lot of great response from the university and from a lot of the local archaeologists. So we hope that we can extend our time. But the fact is Iran is opening. The Middle East is changing. There's going to be a lot of opportunities for this type of work all over the Middle East in the next 10 years. So whether it's in Kurdistan or it's in Iran, we'll probably be in the Middle East for at least 10 years.
Oh, well, Turban, I hope if ever you do come back, you'll come into the studio and we can talk to you face to face. It would be terrific to meet you. Good luck and safe expeditions.
It would be my pleasure.
That's a great story, isn't it? Turban Hartnell, archaeologist and assistant professor at the American University of Iraq. It's of a one with that discussion about Gertrude Bell that we had with Alan Gold, do you remember, earlier last year, which prompted so many of you to write to us and say, why haven't you heard of Gertrude Bell, Geraldine? Well, I have now. So they're extraordinary stories, really are, aren't they? Epic. And there's a great picture of Turban at work with some of his students on our website if you care to have a look.